This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And I just want to say that for some of you, it's all rear view. Some others of you, the excitement of everything is still up ahead. And for others, it's right now, the present moment. And you are kind of like the bug on the windshield of now. When do you peak in your life? That's the question. Depending on vocation and endeavor, you are favored to do your best work in your 20s or 30s, maybe even your 70s. Hey, Ian McKellen is with us this hour, and his 30s are certainly in his rear view. We'll talk about all of that. Also, a look back to when opinion talk radio was once union radio. Today, the labor movement is a bit of a shrinking violet in the media.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio for all my union friends that are out there. Tip of the day.
Labor has a bad habit of not talking about the good things that they do, and they also seem to shy away from media in general a little bit. They kind of keep to themselves. And when you do that, then you're allowing whoever wants to take shots at you to have more of a voice.
But we begin with the unrest in Ukraine. Bonfires in Independence Square in Kiev, the Ukrainian capital. A smoke haze lays over the city today after a night of violent fighting between government forces and protesters. Dozens are dead, hundreds are injured. We turn to a weary eyewitness of the past few days, Zinan Zawada, a political analyst at Concord Capital Investment Bank and writer for the Ukrainian Weekly, based in Parsippany, New Jersey.
Fortunately, Kiev, the city, is in flames, or at least parts of it.
What has changed in the last 24 hours? Take us through what you've observed over the last day.
Well, this weekend there was an attempt at compromise, and the opposition actually offered some concessions. However, the government was not very responsive to those concessions, and the protest that was planned for yesterday, Tuesday, was planned as a peaceful march, but things got out of control very quickly. Government troops prevented protesters from getting near the parliament building, which greatly frustrated them. One thing led to another. Of course, they're accusing each other of starting the conflict, but once the violence started, with the protesters claiming it was for stun grenades from the government soldiers, things just spiraled greatly out of control to the point where the main square where the protests have taken place was taken under siege by riot police who firebombed it using Molotov cocktails themselves.
Zinan, isn't it in the interest of the opposition to escalate this conflict, to keep it as high profile as possible? And wasn't there an expectation that if the protesters tried to reoccupy the parliament building, that there would be a response given what's happened over the last several weeks?
The opposition leaders have been trying their very best to avoid any violent flare-up. There are several reasons for this, one of them being that they are fearing having to face criminal responsibility for any violence. Also, from a moral point of view, they don't want to take moral responsibility for leading people into violence. So I would argue that they've been doing their hardest to prevent people from reacting this way. But the protests, to a large degree, have been beyond their control.
Where does it go from here?
There's very dim signs of a peaceful resolution. The government is highly inflexible and it's hostile towards the opposition, and there's not much hope for a way out. European diplomats are on their way, but so far the solutions being proposed by the West have been inadequate.
All right, Zinan Zawada, political analyst at Concord Capital Investment Bank and writer for the Ukrainian Weekly, based in Parsippany, New Jersey. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We turn now to John Herbst, former ambassador to Ukraine from September 2003 to June of 2006. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I've been seeing many, many live shots from Kiev, commentators attempting to describe what's going on and attempting to predict what happens next. And it really does seem as though neither side has the ability to decisively produce an outcome. And the people of Ukraine, it seems to me, are just cowed in their homes, just hoping that this all blows over. And that is a recipe for a stalemate.
I think you're right that this thing has been going on for just about 3 months because neither side is able to impose its will on the other and because there's been inability for the sides to reach compromise. This thing will only be resolved if either Yanukovych is able to repress the protesters, which I don't think he'll be able to do, or if the two sides reach a compromise. Yanukovych's strategy has been to fluctuate between offering half-hearted compromise, half-hearted concessions, and repression, which he can't quite pull off. And this continued again over the past couple of days. There were talks over the weekend about amnesty for protesters. That would be a government concession. And withdrawal from buildings, that will be a protester concession. And those steps appear to have been taken. But then yesterday, violence flared up again. It looks like the protesters may have crossed a red line of the government by moving towards the parliament, the Rada. But then the government responded with much too much force, with disproportional force.
Now, we've all been struggling as journalists to discover who it is who has a real stake in escalating the violence here. But what you're describing are two players stumbling into an escalation that perhaps neither of them wants.
Well, I think you have to look at least three different parties in this affair. On the one hand is President Yanukovych and his closest team, especially in the security forces and the police. Then there are the opposition parties and their leaders, Mr. Klitschko and Mr. Yatsenyuk. And Mr. Tyanibok, for that matter. And then there are the protesters themselves, who can be influenced by the opposition leaders, but who are not under their direct influence or control. And certainly the protesters are something of a wild card. I think Mr. Yanukovych's preference was to use force to fix his problems. And it's worth remembering that the initial protests were just about Yanukovych's decision to walk away from an agreement with the EU. But then when he cracked down, protests of tens of thousands turned into protests of hundreds of thousands. Of course, many people in Ukraine are fed up with the authoritarian policies of Mr. Yanukovych. But while he tried repression, each time he's tried it, he's failed. It's not clear he has the forces to really repress the protesters.
So the issue at hand here, and I've heard a number of commentators talk about that Yanukovych has thrown in with Russia, and that's the end of that, and the people of Ukraine are going to have to live with it. This doesn't seem to be about Russia or the EU anymore at all. Don't you think it's more about the pure credibility of the Yanukovych government?
I've said all along, this crisis was made in Ukraine and will be resolved in Ukraine. Outside actors have a role. Russia is the most influential outside actor, and by and large, it's used as influence for deplorable purposes to push the Yanukovych regime to use force. The EU is the next most influential actor because they remain a vision for Ukraine and a possible partner. And we also remain an influential actor, but less so than the other two. Yanukovych thought back in December that the gift from Putin in the form of lower gas prices and loans, $15 billion of loans, would solve his problem. That was foolish because the protesters are not going to find gifts from Russia. In fact, they are gifts because we don't know what hidden price there may be with those gifts. I'm not going to find those gifts to be a reason to back away from its protests against the authoritarian policies of the Yanukovych government. And the EU can do things. The U.S. can do certain things. People are increasingly talking about targeted sanctions against Ukrainian officials responsible for the bloodshed. And that could help persuade influential Ukrainians not to pursue nasty policies.
But what about just right next door in Poland? There is such an obvious model or an attractive model of both prosperity, relations with the EU, and certainly not inconsistent with the way Poland has been for a century. I mean, the government has changed, certainly, but it's still Poland. Can't Ukraine go down that road? Is there any mediating role for a nation like Poland?
There's no question that the Polish achievement is something that Ukrainians who want to close the relationship with the EU understand. Poland itself is trying to be helpful, the Polish government. Mr. Tusk recently spoke just today about possibility of sanctioning nasty people in the Yanukovych government. So again, the Poles also remain a model for the Ukrainians.
You know, as we recall your time as ambassador during a very historic moment in Ukraine between 2003 and 2006, what are your thoughts, your emotions, as you see Independence Square in Kiev in flames right now?
Basically sadness. There was the prospect of violence during the Orange Revolution. But I think it was ultimately the wisdom of then-President Kuchma, who up to that point had a checkered past. He realized that force was not a solution to those protests. Those were protests against the efforts of the government to fix the presidential election, the then successful efforts to fix the presidential election. And the Orange Revolution prevented that fix from becoming real. But Kuchma was also urged to use force, and he refused. And that was to his honor. And then the two sides reached a political compromise. And that could still be the outcome today in Ukraine, although the fighting makes that less likely.
John Herbst, former ambassador to Ukraine from September 2003 to June 2006. Ambassador Herbst, thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you.
To see a photo slideshow of the Ukrainian protests, you can visit thetakeaway.org. Today on the program, it's the septuagenarians versus the 30-somethings. Depending on your chosen vocation in life, you could be expected to peak in your 20s, perhaps your late 30s, or even your 70s. The average is in your late 30s, and we'll talk about that a little later this hour. But Sir Ian McKellen, he's a knight in his mid-70s and still taking on amazing challenges.
I played Waiting for Godot in a township just outside Cape Town, Kyalicha, where they had never seen a play before. And they brought their babies, they whispered through it and were very excited. And we were all a bit nervous. How is this play? How would this audience discover it? And I came on as a poor old go-go who's slept the night in a ditch and been beaten and is aching all over and wants to get his boot off because it's hurting so much and he can't do it. And he gives up and says to the audience, the first line of the play, nothing to be done. And I swear there was a collective sigh from 2,000 people who'd lived through apartheid.
Sir Ian McKellen bringing Samuel Beckett and Waiting for Godot to people in South Africa seeing theater for the very first time. More of Ian McKellen later this hour. Is it your late 30s or your mid-70s where you plan to peak? 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Come now and let's spin the old retro radio dial and tune in what sounds like an underground broadcast from some nation in the midst of an economic revolution.
A typo talks it over on Meet the Union Printers. The real reasons behind the newspaper strike in Chicago.
That's a clip from a 1947 broadcast from WCFL, the Chicago Federation of Labor's radio station. There was another time in America when opinion radio was the norm, when radio stations represented different points of view, and American unions once produced and funded more than 250 programs with loyal, daily, national audiences, hosts with names like Guy Nunn and Edward P. Morgan. So instead of Rush Limbaugh making his pro-business right-wing case on his radio show, here you have a representative of the Chicago Typographical Union Local 16 making his case on that city's newspaper strike.
I'm the man in the middle. Call me John Q. Public, if you like. I'm here tonight because everybody says that John Q. Public is the man in the middle when employers and employees can't get together and a strike is called. Now, I don't know where that idea started, because when you come right down to it, practically everybody is either an employer or an employee, and who's left over to make up the public? It seems I'm left over, the man in the middle.
The man in the middle, speaking on WCFL, the Chicago Federation of Labor's radio station in Chicago. Where is this radio labor tradition today? Elizabeth Phones Wolf joins us, history professor at West Virginia University, author of Waves of Opposition, Labor and the Struggle for Democratic Radio, 1933 to 1958. Also with us is Angela Bachman, who's co-host and executive producer of The Union Edge. That's the only nationally syndicated labor program in the country right now. Angela is also a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 5. Angela, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So now your top story probably over the weekend was this vote at the Volkswagen Chattanooga plant voting against the United Auto Workers Union, against the organization, something like that, right?
Yeah, it was. Most of the unionists still have their chin up and say, we're going to try again.
So, Elizabeth, long before there was public radio, what was democratic radio exactly?
Democratic radio was the concept that all voices should have a voice on the air. And this actually doesn't really fully develop until after 1945.
Now, for decades, Elizabeth Phones Wolf, it's been the case that foreign factories in the United States producing automobiles have been largely non-union. If the union radio movement had been as vibrant in the 80s and 90s and the early decades of this century, do you think that would be the case today?
No, I think that people, when they tune into television, there would be actually network programs that would be sponsored by the labor movement that would be presenting labor's opinion. They'd also be able to hear it on the radio. There would be a more sort of vibrant internet and website presence, so people would hear labor's voice and they would have a better understanding of what the changes that were taking place in the workplace, and the better understanding about why it's important for workers to have higher wages, to have secure pensions, and to have representation of the workforce. And these are ideas that simply are not part of the public consciousness today.
Angela Bachman, is that because labor has a face for radio in the sense that the union face, the face of American workers, doesn't work on television in some sense? What is the defensiveness about labor on American television and other media?
I don't think it's that, but I do think that labor has a bad habit of not talking about the good things that they do. And they also seem to shy away from media in general a little bit. They kind of keep to themselves. And when you do that, then you're allowing whoever wants to take shots at you to have more of a voice.
So you're really a 21st century pioneer in that you're really out there in the media. I mean, you have a nationally syndicated labor program called the Union Edge. What do your listeners say about the reputed decline of the American labor movement? What are they saying about the Chattanooga vote? And do you think that there's a way of turning this around in some sense, even in the media?
I think there is. I think that a lot of people are looking to engage young workers. A lot of people are looking to continue organizing and revitalize the movement. And we've seen in places like Michigan, where right to work has become a thing, there's still a lot of organizing happening, which is a little bit opposite of what you would expect. So I think that people who really believe in it are still fighting. And it's also really important that we're bringing in young people who haven't grown up with unions and trying to educate people on how it works.
Elizabeth Phones Wolf, do you believe there's a media future for the American union movement?
Yeah, and I think that more people, they're listening to radio in their cars. And so perhaps it would be something like a all-union radio station that you could subscribe to listen to in your car. So I think there is a future. And, you know, one of the important things is that labor has such a negative image for most Americans. When you say the word organized labor, the first thing that comes to their mind is a mob figure or a sort of corrupt and greedy figure. And this is a image that has been pounded into the minds of the American people really since the 1930s, since the rise of organized labor. There have been concerted efforts to make Americans have negative attitudes towards labor. And I think what we've seen in the past 25 years is the success of this long-term ideological campaign to really delegitimize the idea of collective action.
Elizabeth Fones Wolff is history professor at West Virginia University, author of Waves of Opposition, Labor, and the Struggle for Democratic Radio, 1933 to 1958. She spoke with us from Morgantown, West Virginia. Professor, thanks so much.
Sure.
And Angela Bachman is co-host and executive producer on The Union Edge, the only nationally syndicated labor radio program in the country. Also a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 5. Thanks so much, Angela.
Thanks for having me.
We are touring the decades here this hour. A new study says you're most likely to do your best work in your late 30s. What do you think about that? What was your most creative and successful professional period?
Hi, my name is Ben Halber. I'm from Fitzgerald, Georgia. When I was 30, I decided to start college. It's been 5 years now, 35 years old, and I'm 3 months away from a master's degree in accounting.
Hey, professional accountant. There you go. What's your best decade? Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway. All one word, at The Takeaway. Here's a labor issue you might hear on union radio, the debate over the minimum wage. Does it help people at the bottom of the labor force, or does it give employers an excuse not to hire or to lay people off? It's a solid wedge issue between market-based Republicans and social safety net Democrats. But the Independent Congressional Budget Office yesterday tried to provide some much-needed clarity for lawmakers considering a raise in the minimum wage from the current federal level of $7.25 an hour. The report looks at the impact of the minimum wage being raised to $9 an hour versus $10.10 an hour. Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC, always gives us clarity. Charlie, welcome to the show.
I will try on this.
So the CBO weighs in here. Do they help? What do you think?
No. I think what they come in and say is that the obvious, if you increase the minimum wage and you make minimum wage, if you keep your job, you're going to make more money. But then they also come out and say if you increase it to $10.10, this 10-10 option that the president has been talking about, that there could be anywhere from zero jobs lost to a million jobs lost.
Zero to a million.
Zero to a million.
Really tight tolerance there.
Yeah, a little difference there. And they estimate that about 500,000 jobs could be lost because of raising the minimum wage, because employers decide, look, I'm going to use some new technologies to maybe replace minimum wage workers, or maybe with these higher wages, it's costing me more to make goods, so I have to raise my prices, so therefore people aren't buying as much stuff as I have, and as a result, I'm not hiring as many people. So, you know, what really this report does is it kind of jumps right into the middle of this debate between Republicans and Democrats. You had yesterday the White House coming out pretty forcefully against this report, saying, you know, it has elements in here that seem to indicate that we can disagree with that the number of jobs created. And we think zero is a total, you know, totally good number of jobs that won't be destroyed. And then you have Republicans jumping in saying, oh, wow, if you increase the minimum wage, a million people could lose their jobs.
Well, the frustration here is that instead of providing clarity, it's given ammunition to both sides
exactly.
to continue the debate exactly the same way that it's been going. Anything surprising here?
Not necessarily. I mean, the fact that if one thing did stand out to me, that if you raise it to 10-10, about a million people may be moved out of poverty by raising out the by raising up the minimum wage.
Sure.
But that only represents about 3% of the people that are estimated to be below the poverty level in 2016. So, you know, this question about what is the purpose of the raising the minimum wage? Is it to get people out of poverty? Is it to try and create jobs? Like, why do we want to do it?
Is it just a feel-good symbol?
Is it a feel-good?
Yeah.
I think there is some definite, you know, if you see a million people or so get out of poverty, that's a good thing. And it probably would raise wages for people who make above that because there's just a general effect of pushing wages up.
Right.
So there could be an overall benefit from it. But I would just leave it with this final point that there was a recent study that looked at economists asking them the benefits of minimum wage of raising it. And about a third said that it would make it harder to find jobs. About a third said that it wouldn't make it harder to find jobs. And a third said they weren't really sure. So there's
that gives the Congressional Budget Office a little bit of cover there, that if economists can't find consensus, one wouldn't expect the Congressional Budget Office to find
it. I just kind of love that the number of jobs lost could be zero to a million.
Somewhere in there, folks. Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
So top five in the world sounds pretty impressive, right? Everywhere. In academics, wealth, life expectancy, and in sports. And it sounds impressive everywhere except in the Olympics.
It's the Olympics, and I fourth place, I will take it.
Fourth is the worst position to finish. You just missed the podium. Like, I missed it by 0.2.
When you fall in the Olympics, I guess there's not so much chance for a medal.
Somebody has to be fourth, and that's me.
You're that close. It's just like,
yeah, well, fourth place is not that sweet.
I'm pretty happy with my fourth place, even though it's a bummer not to get that medal.
No medal for fourth place. Forget about fifth place. It means that the backstory of the Olympics is that nice folks finish not last, but fourth. Tamara McKinney knows that feeling from the 1984 Sarajevo Olympics. Tamara, welcome.
Nice to talk to you, too.
So what happened back in 84, and what did fourth feel like back then?
Well, you know, I have to say that every 4 years, that's the question that America wants to know. And it's interesting to me because, you know, I was fourth in that race. And obviously, to be the best in the world, we're all trying to win a gold medal in the Olympics. Sure, that's the dream, and it's not just a passing thing. That's a lifetime of work, and not just for the athlete, but the people who support them. As I watch the Olympics this year, and the focus that I hear from the American media's representation is that they're the gold medal and then the rest of the losers. And I think it's just abhorrent.
I pick up on that, too. I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, it's gold medal or nothing. And really, winter sports are not followed by Americans. They're a very unsophisticated winter sports audience. And you've won 18 World Cup victories. Really, the World Cup and the World Championships are often a better competition because it's the real cream of the crop in those sports, whereas the Olympics is everyone in the world.
I'm sitting here with Michelle Rudigoz, who was my coach in the 1984 Olympics, and we're talking about this. So in 1984, to kind of broaden the spectrum, our team, out of the first four places, we were 1, 2, and 4. I won the second run. Debbie Armstrong had the race of her life. She had never been on the podium before, and she won. That was her day. And I had, you know, carried the weight of the nation as a 20-year-old, but I had been a seasoned veteran, and I'd won the World Cup the season before. It was the first time that I had that weight of the nation on me, where I was still doing my training, but I was taking red-eye flights to, you know, basically raise money to get the whole team sponsored to go to the Olympics.
Well, certainly your success, your responsibility and the success of that 1984 team bears remembering. And even though you only got fourth place, I mean, you went on to be recognized by any skier of any kind as one of the absolute best in the world.
You know, when we talk about whatever place, obviously everyone would love to win the Olympics, right? But if you go back to what the Olympic spirit is, to try the very best, to do the best that you can, and on that day, you know, the best one wins, and that's sport, right? That's if we raised our children and coached our children with the mentality that is represented by the media about the Olympics, right now, they would never make it to the Olympics. So for me, I was fourth. I was trying to win. I had a disappointing first run, but I came and won the second run, and I felt great about my efforts. And I found a new move in my slalom training where I came out and won the next few races and won the slalom World Cup.
All right.
That's life, you know?
And, you know, certainly we want to celebrate you as being one of the best skiers of all time in the world. You took fourth place at the 1984 Winter Olympics in Sarajevo. Tamara McKinney, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So I want you to check this out now. Here's a guy who's having the time of his life in his mid-70s. Listen.
In the original London production, Wait If You Got A, both the main characters were played by people in the under 40, and Gogo, Peter Woodthorpe, a friend of mine, was 24 when he played Gogo. He couldn't have done it. Gogo is at least 74. It's stated in the play. So I think people's confusion with the play way back was that the actors weren't in the position to make the characters real in the way, you know, we've both been talking about.
Real characters, actor Ian McKellen on Broadway in Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, at age 75, playing the real character, he says. He will talk about his many decades as an actor a little later in the program, but staying fresh and open to something new, an opportunity, an idea, a creative impulse, this is a struggle and a mission for so many of us. And different professions have their favored decades. Maybe for mathematicians, it's in your teens or 20s. But a new study from the National Bureau of Economic Research says most creative breakthroughs are actually made in one's late 30s. Joining us with his thoughts is David Shank, author of The Genius in All of Us, New Insights into Genetics, Talent, and IQ. David, welcome back.
Hi, John. How are you?
Just fine. I'm very comfortable in my late 50s, and I want to say that right here at the outset. What do you think this study shows, and is it another reason to, you know, stay in bed?
Yeah, I think after you turn 40, you should just hang it up. You and I should just hang it up, John. No, I think that this really confirms, a lot of really interesting things, but most especially it confirms that although the majority of great achievers tend to do their work in their 20s and in late 30s when it comes to intellectual creative pursuits, actually we're not tied to that at all. So I think the danger is you'd read the first, you know, line of this study and you'd walk away thinking that after you get into your 40s and 50s and 60s, it's all over. Really, what it tells us is that great achievements are the result of life circumstances, whether we have the time, as you said, the freshness, the energy, whether we're not too distracted. And one of the most interesting things here is that the age of great achievement has been slowly increasing, which tells us, again, this is not about biology, but about life circumstances and distractions.
And about the resilience of our society, maybe having children later, maybe postponing marriage, maybe it's the fact that there's a larger number of people who are struggling less than was the case 100 years ago, something like that. It's also the case that one's creative peak isn't necessarily the moment that they make the most money. This study seems to want to point that out as well.
Well, exactly. When you think about it, you know, there, you know, really creative people can do extraordinary things over many, many decades. One of them is going to become maybe, you know, the most famous, and they're going to get the award for that. It may not be actually the most creative or the most interesting thing they do. It just may happen to be the thing that captures the zeitgeist or that, you know, that gets the most acclaim. But it doesn't mean that it's actually the most important or interesting thing they do in their lives.
And people like Mark Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs are outliers in an outlier moment in history, it seems to me, that Steve Jobs came along at a time when American innovation was just absolutely stalled, and he was like the first head to pop up above the ice on some level. And Mark Zuckerberg similarly came at a moment when everyone was looking in one direction in terms of the growth of the internet, and he happened to be looking in another direction. It says much less about them and much more about the society at a moment in time.
I think those are great points, but I would also add that we don't know what the rest of the story with Mark Zuckerberg is. Number one, he could go on to do something else extraordinary. And he might be doing his best work actually right now in keeping Facebook in the public eye and making it even more of a phenomenon. When it comes to Steve Jobs, yes, he did invent Apple Computer when he was a very young man. But I think there's a very good argument that he was doing his best work much, much later than that. I think he kept getting better and better at what he did.
Yeah, I actually don't think that's an argument. I think that's absolutely clear that he did not peak until late. And I think the Pixar innovations and the innovations that produced the iPad and the iPhone are probably more significant than the creation of Apple Computer, which looks more like a footnote today.
Yeah, that's right. So what listeners should take from this is that keep on doing it and never give up, because ultimately the great achievements come from dedication, from focus, and from determination. And Grandma Moses was doing her best work, you know, what, in her 70s and 80s? Ray Kroc invented McDonald's in his 50s. I mean, there's a lot of great work to be done later in life.
I guess the question for the economy as a whole before we go is, do we want to nurture that sort of thing? Do we want to really create an environment that is going to maximize the potential of people in the period from their early 30s to their late 40s?
What we want is to create a health system and an economy where people can be as productive as possible as early as possible and stay productive, maybe take some breaks to dedicate things to family and other things, but then come back and keep on giving and build that wisdom and devote that wisdom to the public.
Oh, there's a good takeaway. David Shagg, author of The Genius in All of Us, New Insights into Genetics, Talent, and IQ. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, John.
Peaking in your late 30s, an entire generation of millennials just let out a collective sigh of relief. There's some time left, folks. From Irving, Texas, I just turned 36 and finally feel like I know what my career is. Congratulations there, Irving. From Boynton Beach, Florida, I will be 30 in about a week. I have two children and am happily married, so now I look forward to my son's birthdays. Hey, Boynton Beach, that will change, but congratulations.
Hi, this is Debbie Rivier-Harris, and I'm from Austin, Texas. My big breakthrough came in my mid-30s, is my confidence as a person. Although I do wish I had gained it earlier in life. I was a wallflower and very shy.
Thanks, Debbie. Confidence is important. Also, what's in your bank account is important. Tell us about the moment when you peaked creatively, personally, professionally, financially. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. There's much more at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
So what do a couple of old Brit guys know about mutants and comics and X-Men?
Doesn't it ever wake you in the middle of the night? The feeling that someday they will pass that foolish law, or one just like it, and come for you and your children.
It does indeed.
What do you do
when you wake up to that?
I feel a great swell of pity for the poor soul who comes to that school looking for trouble.
Sir Patrick Stewart and Sir Ian McKellen playing Xavier and Magneto, respectively, in the X-Men movie franchise. There's a new one being filmed right now. Both men playing mutants as if they were born to it.
Say, I am happy.
I am happy.
So am I.
So am I.
We are happy.
We are happy.
What do we do now that we're happy?
That's Ian McKellen on a Broadway stage with Patrick Stewart and Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, a show they are performing together with the Harold Pinter play No Man's Land. Four actors, Stewart and McKellen, are joined by Billy Crudup and Shuler Hensley for the two-show production running in repertory. Sir Ian McKellen stopped by the green space at WNYC yesterday for a live lunchtime chat with a studio audience. He talked about Beckett, about Pinter, and X-Men, and how he responded when director Bryan Singer thought he would be perfect to play an X-Men mutant.
When Bryan Singer asked me to get involved, I didn't know the X-Men comics. and was a little bit bewildered as to how I could fit in. And he said to me, being a mutant, which is what all the X-Men are, and the difficulties that they face in a society that doesn't like them because they're different, is something that an openly gay person might want to be involved with. And he, Marvel indeed pointed out that the demographic for their popularity is amongst young blacks, young gays, and young Jews. And that those people, having been taught by society that their difference is a disadvantage, would respond to the problems of being a mutant, where your great gifts are not appreciated by society at large. And so I went into X-Men thinking of it as a bit of a political statement and rather than just a distraction from real life. And the whole thing has come to a wonderful thing this week when Ellen Page, who plays one of the mutants, has just come out herself, which is just wonderful. And this is my moment to send her my congratulations because I don't have her email.
You know, she said she got tired of hiding it.
Yes.
Is that an experience you had at what?
Yes. Oh, it's dreadful. The only advantage of being gay is that we've all been through something that straight people don't have to go through. And we are challenged in a way that others are not. And most people, quite rightly, fall in love and take for granted that other people will like the fact that they're in love and want to support them in their love. And if they choose to turn that love into long-term relationship and marriage, then society wants to bolster that and recognise it. And that's not been on off until very recently. And in many parts of the world, including this country, still not possible for gay people. So when Pat Stewart said to me about a year ago, would I marry him, I thought, I didn't know men were allowed to get married in the States. He said, no, he explained, no, he was going to... Actually, I was going to officiate at his wedding. Oh, I see that.
So let's talk for a moment, since you mentioned this sort of mutant, sort of gay idea.
Yeah.
One of the most spectacular movies I ever saw was the movie you were nominated for an Oscar for, Gods and Monsters, about an openly... Yes. How many of you have seen? It's about the director of the classic movie with Boris Karloff, Frankenstein. Jimmy Whale, the director of the movie, is an openly gay director in Hollywood in the 1920s or 1930s?
30s, yeah.
In the 1930s, at a time when this was just utterly impermissible, and he didn't care and did whatever he wanted to. First of all, give me your impressions of that film. I have a couple of questions just about how amazing that film is.
The interesting thing is nobody else cared, and why would they care? I mean, if you're a good director and get on with the job and produce movies like Frankenstein and The Invisible Man and Showboat, who's going to worry what your private life is like? And nobody really did. That wasn't true for actors and still isn't true. But that film catches him at the end of his life, and it's as much about a man who's dying and raging against that as it is about a gay man. But for me and everyone involved in the film... felt that if people enjoyed this film, then that they would know a little bit more about not just Hollywood history, but about what it was like to be a gay person in show business. And it was very close to my heart.
It makes you rethink the movie Frankenstein, which I think played to me in my generation as a sci-fi thriller. But by the end of this movie, you see his open gayness concealing a deeper, darker history of his experience in World War I, which, and the Frankenstein, the movie by the end, is a complete metaphor for his experiences in the trenches. And I was completely blown away by that.
That was another big thing in his life. Yes, he had served in the First World War and survived. And anyone who did that, you know, with millions of young men dying on the battlefield, slaughtered of all nationalities in Europe, if you survived... before thanking anybody, you must have felt guilty. Why was I allowed to live? To see the acres of tombs in Northern Europe where these lads waste. And Jimmy Whale clearly felt that strongly. And I had great love for people who died next door to him, in his arms. Who knows what happened?
It's remarkable. A couple of minutes before we wind up here... can you resolve the whole Godot, controversy? Is that just something the Yanks have messed up again?
No, you know? I don't think so. I mean, written in French, the name would be Godot. But he insisted that it should be pronounced Godot. Why? I also worked out that the tree on the stage, I was very pleased when I thought of this, the tree on the stage is a willow. The French for willow is saule, S-A-U-L-E, saule. So there is constantly in the middle of this play about God, a soul growing.
There is this, I don't know how much television you watch, but thinking about some of the things that cross the Atlantic, there's this Jaguar commercial. I don't know if you've seen it. It's got Ben Kingsley in it.
Oh, yes.
It's getting heavy rotation, and it's all about, like, the bad guys always have British accents.
Oh, dear. Well, at the heart of British theatre is the English language, a language that Shakespeare invented, really, and confirmed. You know, once Shakespeare had happened, the language was never going to be the same. But we're still speaking that language, and we still understand it, and it's popular throughout the world. And so it's the greatest gift that the British actor can have been given to have been born speaking this very complicated, very difficult, beautiful language that can, through which you can say precisely what you mean, precisely what you feel. You can rest on the security of the language. And as I say quite early on in No Man's Land, I'm a poet, I say to the other man on stage, and I say, all we have left is the English language.
Well, thank you so much for glorifying the language and everything else by being with us. Thank you. Our warmest thanks to Sir Ian McKellen, who joined us at the Green Space here at WNYC. And you can check out the full interview at thetakeaway.org. Yeah, that was a big dose of I am not worthy, I am not worthy. From Hackensack, New Jersey, one of you writes, milestones means the most to me, including finding someone special and starting a family, also to be able to be more financially stable, to take on those new responsibilities. What decade does that happen for you? Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.